closer. We had thought that the war would be an end to it, but Octavia says it was just the beginning. Moral degeneration, turmoil, natural order being turned upon its head. These are the signs that the millennium will begin. God decreed that we must prepare a house big enough for 24 bishops to stay in when they come here to Bedford to open the box, Octavia says. As you all know, we were able to buy Castleside, and I am very pleased to report that the renovations are almost complete. We thank Kate for her tireless efforts overseeing the building work and the purchase of furniture for the bishop's arrival. In the next few months, I will be asking you to give all you can to make sure their stay with us is as comfortable as possible. Please start to give some thought to the household goods, practical and ornamental, that you can donate. Edgar raises his hand. Octavia, I would be only too happy to coordinate the... That will not be necessary. I have lots of ideas. I'm sure. But when it comes to decoration, I think we need a woman's touch and an English eye. Your nation is famous the world over for many things, Edgar, but good taste is not one of them. He goes to say more, but thinks better of it. Besides, she says, I have already decided that Dillis will oversee the finishing touches. It takes a moment for me to realize whose name she has said. I hear it whispered as a question from the rows behind. Dillis? Surely she has made a mistake. Edgar turns as if to look at me, but it is Donald's eye he finds. I know what they are thinking, and they are probably right. I have never been in charge of anything before. I am not being in charge material. Octavia cannot see that behind her Emily is greeting the announcement with a disapproving shake of her head. Dillis, did you hear me? Octavia asks, as though she is saying it for the umpteenth time. You have a lot of work to do. I nod quickly before she changes her mind. For those who have not yet seen the truth, the details can be a little difficult to digest. Octavia knows that. She has read the letters from the ignorant and angry who have seen her in the papers, though Emily says enough is enough and has taken to hiding them before she can see the words. Blasphemer. Harridan. Deluded harpy. Perhaps Octavia was testing Grace to see whether she would run at the first opportunity. But here she is. She came and sat in the seat beside me. Donald wasted no time in vacating it straight after the service. Edgar appeared and said something about rushing off for their Bible study, but I think his haste had more to do with hurt pride. After all the hints he has been dropping to Octavia about Castleside, I think he felt sure that he would be chosen to finish furnishing it. But when he made that comment last week about dowdy English decor, I could tell her mind was made up against him. Octavia is... Grace makes a noise while she finds the words. Not quite a sigh. Not quite a laugh. A woman standing and preaching like that. I've never seen anything like it. It's quite shocking. And marvellous. Her wonder makes me feel ashamed. I've taken all this for granted. I didn't choose this life, it chose me. Perhaps that's the reason God has sent Grace, so I can see through her eyes, so I can see how lucky I am. When Octavia talked about being the daughter of God, did she mean that we are all his children? She says. It sounded more than that. Like she thinks. She pauses. Dillis, do you believe she is his daughter just as Jesus is his son? This is where it could all unravel. This is where Grace might turn and run. The truth can be difficult to swallow. The Church of Men believes in the Holy Trinity, but we believe that God is fourfold, I say. Father, Son, Holy Ghost, and daughter. So is Octavia, Do you believe this is the second coming? No. The Lord has sent her to prepare the world for Christ's return. Only then will evil be defeated. I see, she says, looking down at her hands. But I'm not sure that she does. There is a lot to understand, I say. It takes time. I wish she would say something. Tell me what she is thinking. It is quite an honour for you to be here, I say. Octavia doesn't usually. I look up and see Ellen making her way across to us. I can't help feeling angry. The others crowded around Grace straight after the service with words of welcome and promises to share their favourite scone recipes. If Octavia has singled her out, then it's best they make a good impression. But their good impressions took a full half an hour to make. Welcome, Miss Hardwick. Ellen offers her hand to Grace, who shakes it with the tenderness of an old friend. Thank you. It's an honour to meet you. Ellen is not a vicar's wife or a curate's daughter. In a past life, she was a suffragette, sent to Holloway Prison for her crimes against femininity. When she became weary of the fight to infiltrate the world of men, she set her sights much higher, on the kingdom of God himself. But she still wears the starched, strapped neck collars, puffed sleeves and men's neckties of her youth, and she is still slim enough to fit them. Octavia said you were the one who realised, Grace says, that she was... Yes, it was quite a time, Ellen replies, when we knew God's will was being done. And in Bedford. I am pleased that you are here. Welcome to the garden. You have been given a chance to be part of the answer. Isn't it exciting? It is, Grace says, as if she is answering her own question. It really is. And then she looks at me, her eyes searching mine for something. Is it confirmation? Ellen lays her hand on my shoulder. I'll leave you young ladies to your conversation. I'm afraid it is time for me to head back home for an early night. Good night, Ellen. Sleep well. As she opens the door, I see that night has closed in. It is getting late, I say to Grace. Do you have to go too? It's just there's so much I want to know. About what Octavia said. About the box. Have you ever seen it? Me? No. I'm not sure that even Octavia has been told exactly where it is. But when the time comes, she knows who to contact. The South Cottians have been keeping it safe since Joanna died. And why do the bishops have to be the ones to open it? I'm sorry, do you mind all these questions? I should say. Ask away while you can, before Octavia comes to think you have heard all the answers you need, because after that, asking questions will be forbidden. Instead, I say, I don't mind at all. They represent the 24 elders sitting around God's throne. Chapter 4, Book of Revelation. When they come, we will know the time is right. And in the meantime, we wait. We prepare for his arrival. We write to the bishops and we try to make them see the truth. But that's not going to happen without pressure from the masses. Octavia and Emily are designing posters which we're going to put on billboards and buses all across London. They can't ignore us forever. But if there's even a chance it really does contain the answer, she says, her excitement obvious now. Then why wouldn't they open it? I shrug. Stubbornness. Octavia says they do not appreciate being dictated to by a woman. A noise escapes from her throat. Amusement. Recognition. But what do you think is inside it? All we know is that Joanna wrote instructions and sealed them in a chest. I don't know what they say. It is not our place to know, or to imagine. Only to trust. The box holds the answer that will free us from all this mess. No more pain, no more suffering. no more loneliness. But don't you wonder? She falls silent for a moment. I suppose that's what faith is, being part of all this. It must be like being wrapped up in something warm and wonderful. She turns to look at me, but I keep staring forward. I don't know what to say, so I say what I am supposed to feel, what I have felt since I began to see the society through her eyes. It is. I think it's something I'd like to be part of, if Octavia would allow it. She has been so welcoming. You all have. I turn to her and she is looking straight into my eyes. Do you think she would let me join? She says. It usually takes time. She has to trust you. Some members have had revelations, knocked on the door and never left. Is that what this is? A revelation? I don't know. I feel something. I'm drawn to this place. I'm drawn to Octavia. When she spoke tonight, it felt right. And sitting here with you, is that a blush? Warm and wonderful, just like she said. Suddenly, that's how it feels. She might. Sometimes Octavia just decides on a person and nothing can sway her. Like Emily. She came to us as staff. Emily, Mrs. Goodwin, was a servant. Of sorts. She didn't have the means to rent a room, so she worked for us around the house. Before she became too important to sully her hands with such things. So you think Octavia might consider it? Perhaps. I look towards the door. But are you sure, leaving all that? Out there. She looks out across the garden as if she can see straight through the wall and out to the street on the other side. There's nothing I'd miss. I have no family left. My job, well, it pays for my lodgings, but my manager, Mr. Marshall, expects more from me. Because he pays my wages, he seems to think he owns me. This is not a place to run away to. She swallows hard. I'm not running. I know, but why don't we pray about it? We bow our heads and silently I plead with God to let her join us. Not for him, or for Octavia, not even for Grace. I pray that he will let her join us for my sake. To those desiring to join the community, you have expressed a wish to come and live with us in the Panacea Society in Bedford. You must weigh carefully whether this is a divine drawing or merely the result of your wanting to leave duties which you do not care about, or relatives with which you are not in sympathy, or to love of adventure or desire for change. You are advised, therefore, to take 7 days consideration, asking to be shown clearly whether any of the above reasons are urging you, or whether it is a divine leading which justifies you in overcoming all obstacles in pursuance of your desire. If a person has their own dress money and is willing to do domestic work, which will save us a servant's wages and relieve us of the need to have an outsider, they would have board lodging free. No wages would be paid in this case. 3 Divine Commands. 1. All living in community must report faithfully anything in their own conduct which they judge to be provocative of discord among others. 2. They must be willing to be reported by others and to have no malice against them, nor to misjudge them in the performance of this duty. 3. Also, they must report others who fall short of the standard which they know will be required of them as citizens of the New Jerusalem. Let it be clearly understood that none of the rules and regulations operating here are matters for you to have any opinions on. On our part, we shall understand that by deciding to come here, you agree to all the foregoing and that you will submit completely. Spring. The simple facts are that God requires a few sensible, matter-of-fact women to take on the housekeeping on earth and to begin to give their orders by word of mouth and on his behalf until the defeat of Satan and the divine jurisdiction begins. Octavia. Wash day. Grace wakes me with a knock on my bedroom door. She has brought a bowl of hot water, as usual, but I ask her to leave it outside the door. I don't want to see her. Or rather, I do not want her to see me. Not until I am presentable. Able to be present. Not until I have pieced myself together, washed away the dreams of the night before, brushed my hair, dressed my body to give myself the appearance of being in control. We spend so much time trying to tame our bodies. We make them look neat and obedient, but beneath our disguises they are still wild. They still bleed. And so I wash away the smells of earth and brine, the cloying sweetness of rotting fruit. Eve's apple. Grace is our servant now. She joined us every Sunday in chapel, and after 6 weeks Octavia asked her to stay. I didn't interfere or make her case. I only hinted that it might be time for us to find some help for Ellen. But Octavia had a better idea. Ellen won't have the energy to train her, she said. Better that Betty goes to Ellen and Grace moves in here. I knew without a doubt that the Lord's hand was at work again. Octavia said it was surely part of a divine plan. It was only later that it occurred to me that with a follower in post, she will also be saving 8 shillings and tuppence a week on wages. That was a week ago. It feels like longer. When Grace first moved in, I worried that some of our familiarity had gone. It bolted away like a dog into the woods, and though I tried to call it back, I feared it was lost. For days I'd hardly see her at all. When I poked my head into the kitchen, I'd usually find her with Emily, being instructed on the way Octavia likes things done. At mealtimes, when she carried in the plates, I would ask Grace whether she was well, whether she had settled into her bedroom, whether it was starting to feel like home. With the others present, all she could say was, "Yes, thank you, miss," before rushing out to start her next chore. But she would always pause, just long enough to find my eyes and give me a look that only I could see. I don't have long before she will knock again. In the mirror above my washstand, I style my hair. I like unravelling the strips of cloth I tie each night. Ribbons of brown spring out and bounce, jostling for space in line beneath my jaw. But I'm careful never to glance at my face. It reminds me who I am. I see the ghost of my father's eyes. Sensitive. Too sensitive. They are not quite hazel, not quite green, not quite sure what they want to be. If I looked at my reflection, I would see the same nose that grew out of my brother Eric's face when he changed from a boy into a man, before he went to war and never came back. It would remind me that I am here, and they are not. And of course, whenever I look, I see my mother staring back at me. Another knock. I have your breakfast tray. Grace again. Half an hour has passed. May I come in, miss? Sometimes when we are alone, she calls me Dillis. It is our secret. An invisible thread that runs along the landing between our bedrooms. Past Octavia's door, past Emily's. I enjoy the thought of dear Emily tripping on it and falling down the stairs, hair streaming down behind her, the sharp knocks of bone against the walls, the stairs, the banister. But that's the devil. He whispers still. I must not give him a foothold or I shall be the one falling. Down to hell. Did you sleep? I ask. It has become a ritual. I greet her with the same question every morning, and she always gives the same answer in return. Like a top. It's a saying that always seemed wrong to me. Spinning tops are frantic. They twirl, they turn. But Grace told me that's the joke of it. Look at them from above and they seem to be completely still. The faster they spin, the more firmly they are pinned to the spot. It is when they lose momentum that they falter. "And how did you sleep, Dilys?" she says. "Like the dead." I always say this too, though it is very rarely true. I try to sleep, but thoughts knock me in too many directions. Dreams veer too violently from one story to the next, until I topple back into consciousness. "Is Octavia unwell?" I ask her. "One of her headaches?" I know there's something wrong, or she would be insisting that we gather at the dining table this morning as usual. "She couldn't face breakfast," she says. "Emily came down early and asked to take hers in her room, so Peter is down there by himself." She places the tray onto my bedside table, then looks up at me mischievously. "Would you rather join him? I assumed you would prefer it up here, but I can..." "No, no, I wouldn't want to trouble you," I interrupt her with a grin. "Up here is fine. It looks delicious, thank you." Breakfast this morning is eggs. Octavia says there are 52 ways to prepare them. One of her sermons in chapel, perhaps. Deviled eggs are one of her favourites, despite their name, but this morning they are poached, sprouting pale roots where they swirled in the boiling water. I'll cut them up and move them around my plate. I'll eat the toast, but that's the best I can do. When Betty was here, I wouldn't even bother to pretend, but when Grace prepares breakfast, it feels like a gift, and I don't want to seem ungrateful, throw the present aside without even taking the paper off. I sit down on the bed and pat the space beside me. "I don't have long," she says, taking a seat. "Oh, before I forget, I found this. It's for you." She reaches into the pocket of her apron, pulling out a letter, bringing it close to her chest to hide the writing from me. "Wait until you see the postmark. You'll never guess." I don't need to guess. I know precisely where it has come from. And who. Grace holds the envelope in both hands, turning it as though she can see through the paper to what is written inside. I want to snatch it from her and hide it away in the box inside my wardrobe, where I don't have to think about it. Where I don't have to think about him. "It's from India," she says, as though she is sharing a joke. I can tell she is expecting surprise or delight, but I offer neither, extending only an open hand as a silent command. "It is mine. Give it to me." She obeys. "Dilys, what's the matter?" As if I could tell her that. As if I could begin to explain. She stands, walks to the window and busies herself opening the curtains. "I wasn't prying. I really did find it. At the foot of the stairs." She pauses, but I say nothing to fill the silence. "Emily must have dropped it. She carried up the usual bundle of letters to go through while she took breakfast. Octavia receives an awful lot of mail, doesn't she?" "Octavia does. But there is only one person who writes to me." Grace is still talking, still arranging the folds of the drapes, still trying to get me to speak. "I suppose with 2,000 followers she would." I must say something in reply. Pretend that I am all right. "Not all of Octavia's letters are sent by followers," I explain. "Half are from non-believers. They write to tell her she is a wicked blasphemer, an affront to the church. Octavia says they are crackpots, and as the Bible says, blessed are ye when men shall revile you. We mustn't listen to those who refuse to see the truth. Even those we love. They have made their choice." "Grace," I whisper. I want to tell her she has done nothing wrong. It is not her I am upset with, it is the letter. "Grace." For a moment she does not move, her fingers falling still on the pleats of the fabric, her eyes darting to the envelope, now curled and crushed inside my hand. "Thank you for finding it," I say, opening the drawer of my bedside cabinet and slipping it inside. "It is much appreciated. I'll read it later." The drawer sticks as I push it shut, then suddenly slams, causing the cabinet to wobble and a little water to splash out of a glass on top. "Careful, Dilys," says Grace, stepping forward with a cloth she conjures from another pocket in her apron. "I'm sorry." "I should think so. I've got enough to do today without you making extra work." I think I hear a smile on her lips, and when I look up, I see it there, broadening into a grin. I let out a breath, realizing I've been holding it. "What can I say? I don't know my own strength," I shrug. "You're right, though. You'll be quite behind at the rate you're going. Those curtains," I nod towards the window. "I've never known you be so thorough. Has Emily been giving you instructions on the correct way to open them? Another of her tutorials, perhaps?" "Now, Dilys," she says with affected solemnity, "you know as well as I do that I have to learn the proper ways, and Emily is happy to teach me." All right," I say, lifting my hands in surrender. "Yesterday I nearly served the baked potatoes cut in half instead of scoring them with crosses on the top. Goodness knows what Octavia would have said if Emily hadn't stopped me in time." The frown she has been wearing to entertain me softens. She drops her gaze, her expression suddenly earnest. "I want to stay," she says softly. "There's so much to do, it is exhausting." "I know, I'm sorry. Now I am the solemn one. Forgive me." Meeting my eyes again, she starts to laugh. "Goodness, what has become of me, Dilys? I never used to worry about baked potatoes. I just want to get everything right, that's all. Emily is helping." Emily has what most people would call a kindly face. One might even imagine she was pretty once, in her youth. But not me. I can see through her act of cheerful concern. I am not fooled. Everything she does is for show. Every word, every act, an attempt to win Octavia's favour. I was here at the beginning, when Octavia was still called Mabel. Emily came later. She came with nothing and persuaded her to take her in, into her home and into her confidence. And now, every time I walk into a room, she is there, whispering to Octavia, pouring spirits in her ear like Lady Macbeth, or poison like Claudius. "Well," Grace says, "I suppose I had better get on. Emily will have finished her breakfast by now. And poor old Peter is all by himself. I will go and ask him about his plans for the day. I keep trying, but I get the impression he doesn't like me." Surely that could never be. He's rather suspicious of newcomers, that's all. Protective of Octavia. "You're probably right," she says. "And now I shall be protective of you. Eat up. That's an order. Your breakfast will be stone cold if you leave it much longer." It is stone cold already. Once she is gone, I take a few bites of toast, but it's all I can manage. All I really need is spiritual sustenance. I take a square of linen from my bedside drawer and put it into a glass to soak. It takes a few minutes for the healing to infuse the water. I think of it like tea leaves releasing clouds of amber into the pot, tendrils growing out towards the edges of the glass, but there's nothing to see. Nothing but breath. At first, Octavia had to work on each pint of water to transfer her divinity, but now she's found an ingenious method of storage and supply. She breathes on fabric so that the healing can be dispensed whenever and wherever it's required. God's grace in a glass. She's nothing if not practical. That's why it's up to women to save mankind. Men just can't get themselves organised. Too busy waging war or trying to beat each other at cricket. I drink the water twice a day. More if Octavia thinks I need it. It helps me to think less and believe more. It helps me to drown out the devil when he whispers in my ear. And to drown out the words I know I will find in Adrian's letter. This religion is all wrong. It will make you ill if you stay. Write back and let me know that you are safe. But I won't. I will sit and drink the water instead. I can hear Grace back in the kitchen below me. Today is Monday, wash day. It means she'll be gathering the soap and soda, scrubbing my sheets against the ridges of the washboard. Sometimes I stand and watch her from the kitchen doorway, sleeves pushed up her arms, muscles and sinew moving beneath her skin. She shows me how she prepares the starch for the tablecloths. The recipe has to be followed exactly. Grains added first to cold water, then to hot. She must stir thoroughly and keep constant watch, otherwise it will thicken and go lumpy. But I won't visit her in the kitchen this morning. I have work to do. Octavia's words to type. So I will sit here at my little desk by the window and watch the sheets blowing on the washing line. Puppets with invisible strings. Leaping and dancing before the Lord. The second book of Samuel, chapter 6, verse 16. If only our souls could be cleansed so easily. The Lord will not come to us until we are pure. That is why Grace is here. That is why God sent her to me, to keep constant watch on my soul. Later, when I return from chapel, I will find a clean nightdress under my pillow. I will take off these clothes, savour a moment of anticipation before I slip it on and feel it brush against my skin, a shroud of purity, spotless and clean. And by then I will have left a gift under her pillow in return. The Lord's words. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Psalm 51, verse 7. Castleside. Grace hands me an apple for my first morning at Castleside as I pass the kitchen door. When she calls me Miss, it is no longer a sign of distance. It feels like she is drawing me closer, like she is whispering a joke. I know my lines and the part I must play. Now, Grace, what did I tell you? You needn't call me Miss. After all, we are friends, aren't we? We are, Miss Dillis. And I realise this is what friendship feels like. Knowing what to say, or being happy to say nothing at all. Her eyes dart to something behind me. Good morning, Mrs. Goodwin. I turn to see Emily approaching. What are you two whispering about? She says. Dillis, I hope you're not distracting Grace. So much to do. And shouldn't you be at Castleside by now? I choose not to answer. I carry on speaking as if she is not there. Thank you for my apple, Grace. I'll enjoy that. Emily gives a strange little laugh, which ends abruptly, snatched by the silence that sweeps the room. It makes me feel exposed. No one speaks, but in the blazing silence I can hear their thoughts about me. They know the apple won't get eaten. I had better be getting on, I say, stepping past Emily into the corridor. Emily always says it will do me good to keep busy, that it will take my mind off things. It might be better if I could take my mind away completely, separate brain from body. Dawdling Dillis, you'd forget your own head if it wasn't screwed on. But I'm not as useless as they thought. I've brought Grace to this society, and Octavia has put her trust in me. She really does want me to prepare Castleside for the bishops. Just the finishing touches now, Emily says. Remember, the hard work has already been done. Kate Firth has seen to that. 28 rooms cleaned and decorated, floors varnished, walls painted, furniture moved in. She was given two tasks, to coordinate the renovation and to sign all the checks to pay for the work. But as Octavia said, she could afford it. And as Emily said, she couldn't afford not to. The Lord won't look kindly on those who are not willing to share their blessings, and when it came to raising the funds to buy the property, every member played their part and paid their dues. All were compelled to donate a proportion of their savings. And God was grateful for it. He told Octavia so himself. "Finally, we'll have a place to accommodate the bishops in comfort," she said. "They can have no excuse to stay away now." The garden was ours at last. For years, Castleside cast a hulking shadow over the society. Octavia told us its bricks and mortar were imbued with a malevolent spirit, a devil blighting God's paradise. She would hear its voice tormenting her over the wall. But all I heard was joy and freedom. Schoolboys studying the skills that are required of them as men, swearing and wicket-keeping, fistfights and cruelty. I doubt that any consideration was given to matters of religion at all. We had ceased to be a source of curiosity. There was a time when they would dare each other to jump the wall that lay between the back of the school and our garden, pretending they sought to retrieve a ball that had strayed over. But Octavia put a stop to that. A note sent to the master of the boarders nipped it in the bud. The cane makes a persuasive case, and when it comes to it, a good thrashing is too high a price to pay for a glimpse of most of us. Too old. Too plain. Except Grace. They'd probably have risked it for Grace. The day came when we gathered to knock down the wall. Peter lifted the bricks out one by one. He'd given up with the sledgehammer. Despite the considerable effort it took him to swing it, he achieved little more than a glancing blow, enough to knock him backwards but insufficient to loosen even the smallest piece of mortar. Octavia dressed up for the occasion in her veiled hat and fox stole. Since she has been confined to the garden, she has few opportunities to dust off her finest clothes. Quoting from Ephesians, "For he is our peace, who hath made both one and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us." I think she envisioned the whole lot would come tumbling down like the walls of Jericho. Perhaps if Peter had been given a trumpet, we could have charged through like the Israelites. As it was, he was chipping away with a chisel, refusing Edgar's offers to help. It was Emily who rescued him from the embarrassment of an audience. "Thank you, Peter," she said, stepping forward after several minutes had passed. "You have removed that first brick with such great care. It will be wrapped and kept in the archive as an artifact of this great day. Now, you'll excuse us if we head inside and leave you to your work. I'll send out some refreshments presently." He ended up taking lunch and dinner outside. It took all day, but the wall came down and the garden was doubled in size. Octavia insisted, before the workmen were sent into Castleside, that Peter should fence off the very back of the building with a hoarding of high wooden sheets. She said it was necessary to protect our modesty. She didn't want them to be able to see us. Or perhaps she didn't want us to see them. Temptation would come once more to the Garden of Eden and lead to a surge of sinful thoughts. They might unbutton the tops of their shirts, cotton clinging to the sweat on their chests and backs. They would dig the earth and carry piles of bricks as if they weighed nothing at all. Men can do that. They could carry any one of us away to a secluded spot, and we'd be powerless to resist. Besides, the language of men like that would be coarser than the schoolboys. Coarse like their skin, fingertips rough and unyielding. All these are thoughts that I can talk about in my next confession. The hallway of number 12 is dark. Two shafts of sunlight skulk through glass panels in the front door, but seem to lose their nerve in the gloom, disappearing into the folds of coats that hang on hooks behind the door. Even when I open the door, the light trespasses no further than the doormat, but I feel its warmth on my face as I take a breath. The air tastes golden. At the bottom of the path, I turn left past Rachel Fox's front door, then left again into Castle Road, tracing the boundary of the garden in the streets that surround it. On this side, there are very few windows. Walking tucked in beside the wall, I am hidden from their prying eyes and pocketbooks. I count my steps as I always do. When I get to 77, I know I am beyond Octavia's reach. It's 81 to the driveway of Castleside, but once the renovations are finished, she'll be able to come and go as she pleases through the garden. Well, it's just as well, because when the time comes, she'll have to be here to direct the bishops. She's already picked out a hat and which Bible she will read from, and she's got a beautiful shawl that Ellen made for her with lilies and a cross on the back. She has rehearsed every detail in her head. Who will stand where, what she will say, exactly where the box will be positioned. She speaks about little else these days. I turn left again into Newnham Road, and immediately through the gate of the Haven to knock for Kate Firth. She said she would show me around Castleside herself. I like the way she says it. Castle. With a ca, not a car. But Octavia thinks a northern accent sounds common, no matter how wealthy the speaker is. Kate, are you sure you've got time? I ask her as she opens her front door. Absolutely, she says. It's a pleasure to get out for a while. Just let me get my coat. Last year, Octavia decided the Haven was far too big for a widow to be rattling around in by herself. Far better that Kate has some company. So she asked her to take in new members while they sought more permanent lodgings in Bedford. How many are staying at the moment? I say when Kate returns wearing a black velvet cape with a dusting of tiny glass beads on the collar. Eight. It's a pity we can't move a few into Castleside. But we both know Octavia would never allow it. We may need to receive the bishops at a minute's notice. It would be no good if they arrived to find they were sharing with a house full of women. I look past her, down the hallway towards the source of muddled sounds I can't quite decipher. They are busy rehearsing, she says. The blue room has been taken over for practice. Octavia has asked them to put on a musical evening, and they are keen to make sure they are pitch perfect. Mrs. Ashcroft is a rather talented pianist, so my services won't be required. She turns to the mirror in the hallway, using her fingertips to comb the wave of greying hair that sweeps up into a soft pile on top. Do you play, Dillis? I can't remember ever seeing you perform. That is because I am never asked to. I play a little, I say. Very poorly. Well, we can't all be good at everything, she says kindly. Here, you'll need these. She takes a large bunch of keys from the console table below the mirror and places them in my hand, pausing before her fingers part with them. They are yours now, she says. We walk down the path from the Haven and up the next to Castleside, which looms ahead of us. It looks like it has grown up from the ground in red brick. A jumble of different styles of windows on three stories. Some are bay, some hooded, some clustered in pairs or threes, large rectangular panes and small square grids of glass. The lack of symmetry only serves to emphasize the building's size, dwarfing a small white wooden porch which sits atop the front door. The big one, that's the front key, Kate says. But you'll be able to come through the back now the hoarding's coming down. Peter's been asked to do it tomorrow. That's good, I say. But I'm disappointed that I'll no longer have an excuse to walk the streets outside the garden. Castleside is even bigger than it looks from the outside. A hallway twice as wide as that of number 12, with large rooms leading off both sides. Let's start in here, Kate says. The dining room. We decided it best to serve meals in two sittings. 24 would be too crowded, even in a room this size. A large mahogany table runs down the centre of the room, surrounded by 12 chairs. There's an assortment of crockery on the top. Members have started to bring donations already, Kate says. but odds and ends are no good. You'll need matching sets. Octavia was very firm on that point. I walk across and pick up a side plate, which is stacked on top of a dozen or so more. Garlands of green leaves and white flowers decorate the edges. Don't look so worried, Dillis. There's a full inventory of what we'll need in there, Kate says, pointing at a desk in the bay window at the front of the room. Oh, and while I think of it, the keys are in the top drawer. The only other set, so keep them safe. Back out in the hallway, she points out the encaustic floor tiles, matched with such precision that it is impossible to tell which are new and which were there all along. She explains how the plasterer made a mould of the egg and dart cornice to repair the damage in the corner. The wallpaper here was unsalvageable, I'm afraid. A pity. It was a beautiful print. Exotic birds. Reminded me of a paper we had back in York before the war. She points to a door on the other side of the hallway. That will be a sitting room, she says. Same size as the dining room. And if you follow me, I'll show you to the scullery and kitchen. I'm starting to panic now. There's an awful lot of space to fill. Why has Octavia trusted me with this? It all looks so empty. No pots or pans. No lingering smell of warm bread or old grease. We pass a door to the garden and carry on to a room at the very back of the house. And this is it, she says. The opening room where the bishops will gather to open the box. May I? Taking back the bunch of keys, she finds the right one instantly, a single flash of golden brass among the tarnished iron. Behind the door is a small room, no bigger than Grace's bedroom at number 12. What do you think? She says, evidently enjoying my bewilderment. It's smaller than I imagined. Yes, this is the antechamber, she says, amused by her own joke. The box room, if you like. The opening will take place in here. She opens another door. The sight of the second room is made even more dramatic by its contrast with the first. It must be 4 times the size of our dining room at number 12, with a high ceiling and oak panels lining every wall. I'm rather proud of it, Kate says. And she is right to be. It creates a sense of occasion. Important things happen in oak-panelled rooms. The Houses of Parliament, church vestries, gentlemen's clubs. Places where promises are made and deals struck. Places for men. So, here is where it will happen, I say, more to myself than to Kate. When the lid is lifted, will light pour out and fill the room, or music fill our ears like a heavenly choir? Will the earth shake or the heavens tear apart? None of us knows, not even Octavia. But in that moment, everything will change. All suffering will end. I'm told the box is the size of a large boarder's trunk, Kate says, which is rather apt considering that it will be opened here. Here, where the schoolboys ate and slept, studied and played. We make our way upstairs, and buried beneath the scent of fresh paint lies the faint memory of another, a mixture of unwashed laundry and expectation. After you, Kate says. There are 20 bedrooms, so the majority of the bishops will have their own. 8 of them will have to double up, but we shan't risk them fighting it out amongst themselves. Octavia will draw up a list of who goes where. And there's a bathroom and lavatory on every floor. I see, I say. But I don't see. Not really. I don't see how I am going to fill all these rooms with ornaments and furnishings. It's all been planned out, Kate says kindly. It's just a question of adding the finishing touches, making it look homely. Just like you would a home of your own. But as soon as the words leave her lips, she regrets them. We both know I'll never have my own home to decorate. Kate turns towards the door. I'll leave you now to get your bearings, she says. I wait until I hear the front door behind her. Then I move across the room, walking slowly at first, then stretching my legs to a stride. With each step I place my foot down harder, louder, enjoying the click of my heels against floorboards. I clap my hands together, I whistle. I feel myself growing into this space, echoes filling every corner. There is nobody watching me here. How did this room look when it was a dormitory? Full of books, blazers hanging on the hooks behind the doors. I open the cupboards, hoping to find an artifact left behind, but all that remains is a crude picture scratched into the wood. A body part, a male organ. Detached, dismembered. It looks so small and so childish. A schoolboy's defiance, a risk taken, a rule broken. I shut the door again and hide it away. I shall leave it in the dark. I like the thought of it, the thought that only I will know it's there. Exploring each room in turn, I find every one identical. Bare walls and floorboards, curtainless windows and undressed beds. And a thought scuttles across my skin. They look like cells for lunatics. The whole place a madhouse from which the patients have fled. There's a heaviness in the air. At the very top of the house, I step into a room with the feeling that someone else has just left it. Unlike the rest, its door has been left ajar. And it looks as though the mattress has been slept on. It is dipping in the middle, holding the imprint of a body that it has cradled. I touch it, half expecting to find it still warm. But it isn't. Of course it isn't. Pull yourself together, Dillis. My mind is running wild with childish stories. As if I am Goldilocks and will be faced at any moment with a family of angry bears. But the only thing to fear is Octavia's poor opinion. I really need to concentrate on the job at hand. But starting back down the stairs, I pick up my pace to a run. I can feel my fears lingering in the room behind me. I trip on my own feet. I must take care. Slow down. At the sight of the red carpet on the treads, I picture myself lying at the bottom, just as I have imagined Emily. Relief comes swiftly when my feet reach the tiles of the hallway. Back on solid ground. The same giddy joy I used to feel when I played chase with my brothers in Bedford Park. Tiggy, tiggy, touch wood. I squeeze the banister beneath my hand and remember the terror and the thrill, the dash across the open grass, the exhilaration when I made it to a fence post or a bench and I was safe. Untouchable. Touch wood, Dillis. Touch wood and hope for the best. There is still the sitting room to see. I push the door gently and peek inside. There is nothing more than an empty sideboard, dark wood against walls freshly painted in a deep maroon. This is where the bishops will sit after their evening meal. We'll need chairs. Lots of them. 12 at least, so they can use the room in turns. I'll arrange them in small groups around the fire and in the corners. I'll find side tables and place piles of books on top, perhaps a vase or two, though I'm not sure men care for cut flowers. With a roaring fire, it will be quite cosy. Off the hallway, past the kitchen, I find another door, which Kate did not pause to show me before. When I open it, I'm greeted with a cold blast of air and a darkness that my eyes were not prepared for. It's a pantry. Long and thin, the light from a single window like the mouth of a tunnel. I walk along the empty shelves on either side, listing in my head the foods we'll need to store. Tinned meats and peaches, canisters of flour and sugar, enough to feed the bishops for as long as they decide to stay. There's a crunch beneath my shoes, flashes of brilliant light dancing at my feet. I reach down to catch them and something bites me. There's blood on my hand. Glass. Shattered glass. Wide blades and needle-thin shards glinting up from the floor. That's why it is so cold. A small pane in the window has been smashed. And the catch is open. Someone could have reached in and opened it. Climbed through. Too many thoughts crowd at once. The whens and wheres and whos. Why would they break in? There's nothing to steal here, nothing to take, except what they could take from me. Octavia has told me what men can do, what the wall protects me from. She has never shied away from the facts of life or the sex question, and why the answer must always be no. Someone could have broken in. Someone could be here still, hiding behind a door or beneath a bed. Pull yourself together, Dillis. Those childish thoughts again. The window may have been broken weeks ago. Yes, there's no one here but me. Just me. And nothing will hurt me. Octavia blessed this house herself before the hoarding went up. She crossed the lawn and sprinkled the water on the boundary of every room, breathed her divine protection into every corner. Nothing can hurt me here. I've done all I can today. Seen all I came to see. I run for the front door and lock it behind me, my right hand still bleeding, my left pitted with marks where I've been gripping the keys too tightly. Healing by post. I want to head straight up to my bedroom, but as soon as I step into number 12, Grace appears in the hallway. "You're bleeding," she says, rushing forward to inspect my fingers. "It's nothing, really. I cut it on some glass." Despite my protest, she insists that I take a seat in the kitchen. "What happened?" she says, placing a bowl of warm water on the table beside me. "There was a smashed window at Castleside, in the pantry." "Dillis, your hands are shaking. It gave me quite a fright," I say, more defensively than I mean to. "I'll bet. Perhaps one of the workmen knocked the glass." "Perhaps." She frowns as she leans in to inspect the cut more closely. "You don't sound convinced." I did wonder if someone had broken in. "A burglar?" "I suppose so, but there's nothing to steal, not yet." "I wonder what Octavia will make of it." There's a moment of silence and then I say it. "I don't plan to mention it to her. I don't want to go running for help on my first day at Castleside. I can already hear Emily. I knew she wasn't up to it. Would you like me to take over Octavia?" "No, I won't give her the satisfaction. Octavia put me in charge. I won't let her down." "But aren't we supposed to tell everything?" Grace asks. "I'll mention it to Kate. I'm sure it was an accident. She can ask the workman to pop back and replace the pane." "You're probably right," she says. But now she is the one that doesn't sound convinced. She has wrapped her fingers around mine, cradling them, and I am watching the bowl of water.